Several years ago, I had the good fortune to attend a weekend workshop at the Esalen Institute, located in Big Sur, California. It was a weekend encounter group where you lock up 20 strangers in a room for an entire weekend and see if you can get them to spill their guts. It's surprising how honest people will be in that kind of circumstance. They'll tell you things that they would never tell their husband or their wife or even their closest friend, but they'll tell you because they figure, I'll never see these people again. At the end of the weekend, everybody was saying goodbye, and there was one particular man that I wanted to compliment who had attended that weekend workshop. Each month, Reader's Digest has a column on the most unforgettable person I ever met. Well, this fellow was definitely the most unforgettable person I had ever met. And I walked up to him and I said, you know, I really admire you. And the one thing I admire most about you is your high self-esteem. And that's where he shocked me. He said, Rich, I don't have any self-esteem. I don't value myself highly. I have too many negative qualities, too many faults to have high self-esteem. What I have, and the reason I'm happy, is self-acceptance. And that's what we're going to talk about in today's tape on self-esteem for singles. Before you can have self-esteem, it's much more critical to have self-acceptance. Self-acceptance is that prerequisite for high self-esteem. Without self-acceptance, without being able to give yourself permission to be who you are, you can never have high self-esteem. Self-acceptance is sometimes seen as a synonym for self-esteem, but it's not. If you have high self-esteem, you think you're a wonderful person. If you have self-acceptance, you're not saying whether you're a good person or a bad person. You're not saying you even like yourself. All you're saying is, I'm me, and it's okay. I give myself permission to be myself. So the first goal of this tape is to help everyone develop self-acceptance, to give yourself permission to be who you are, good and bad. And if you can get that far, then we're ready for the graduate level course on self-esteem, how we can change that self-acceptance into self-esteem where you say, not only is it okay to be who I am, it's great to be me. I'm a wonderful person. So let's get back to self-acceptance. How do you give yourself permission to be who you are? It sounds easy, but it's not. You see, society does everything in its power to destroy our self-acceptance. It begins when we're very, very young with our parents. See, usually if we're a typical child, our parents teach us very early on in life that it's not okay to just be me. I have to be a good person. In this particular case, I have to be a good little boy or a good little girl. Now, if we're good little boys or girls, then mommy and daddy like us and approve us and love us, and we wind up having high self-esteem and we wind up being happy. But if we're not little good boys and girls, mother and father will not love us as much, and we wind up having low self-esteem, and we wind up being unhappy. Eventually, we go on to school, and this goodness trap continues. Because you see, our parents not only want us to be good, but so do our teachers. And of course, in school, it gets to be more difficult because we have lots of subjects and lots of teachers. So now we have to be good at spelling, and we have to be good at arithmetic, and good at reading, and good at science, and good at music, and art, and physical education, and foreign languages, and so forth. Now, if we're good at these things, then our teachers approve of us, and we wind up having high self-esteem, and we wind up being happy. But if we're not so good with these things, we wind up having low self-esteem, and we wind up being unhappy. Of course, you can mention recess. It'd be nice to be able to go out on the playground and escape this goodness trap, but it's just the same on the playground. Because now we have to be good at jacks, and we have to be good at hopscotch, and we have to be good at kickball, and we have to be good at baseball, and soccer, and gymnastics, and so forth. Now, if we're good at these things, the reward is high self-esteem and happiness, but if we're bad at these things, the punishment is low self-esteem and unhappiness. And, of course, eventually we graduate from school and we go to work. Here again, we fall into the goodness trap. Now we have to be good in the eyes of our bosses. So we have to be good at typing, or we have to be good at repairing roofs, or we have to be good at doing projects or assignments. If we're good at these things, we wind up with high self-esteem and happiness. But if we're bad at these things, we wind up with low self-esteem and unhappiness. And when we get into romantic relationships, it's the same problem. Again, we are forced to be good. Now we have to be good at a whole host of other things. We have to be good at sharing our feelings. We have to be good at being entertaining in conversation. We have to be good in bed. We have to be good in a whole new set of qualities. And of course, eventually, many of us have children, and now we have to be good parents. And this requires a whole new area of goodness. Life becomes a nightmare. I call this the goodness trap. Society requires that we be good in a whole host of things. Well, the sad problem is that for everything you can be good at, there's an equal chance that you're going to be bad at it. So for every opportunity for high self-esteem, there's going to be an equal opportunity for low self-esteem. And the reality is that each one of us has good qualities and bad qualities. To the extent that we have good qualities, we have the opportunity to develop high self-esteem, but to the extent that we have bad qualities, we have that unfortunate opportunity to develop low self-esteem. Well, I don't know about you, but I don't like to gamble with my happiness. I don't want to be in a situation where my happiness is dependent upon being good. That's what I call the goodness trap. So here's where I'm going to come to the first controversial part of this tape. I'm going to ask you a question that nobody has ever asked you before in your life, and I'm willing to guarantee that nobody will ever be dumb enough to ask you this question again. Here's the question. What's so bad about being bad? Why do we have to be good at anything? What's wrong with just being me, which means being good in some areas and bad in some areas? Why do we have to gamble our happiness on being good in everything? Why can't we be happy regardless of whether we're good or bad? Now, of course, society teaches us that the key to happiness is to be good. If we're good little boys and girls, and if we're good students, and if we're good workers, and if we're good romantic partners, and if we're good parents, then society will reward us with happiness. The reality is that there is no correlation between being good and being happy. For example, there are lots and lots of wonderful, giving, loving, wonderful people who are unhappy. We all know people like this, people that bring incredible joy to the world, but can't bring the joy to themselves. The reality is that you could be the most wonderful person on the planet and still be an unhappy person. And conversely, do you know that there are mafia hitmen right now who are happy people? I'm talking about people who go out and murder people. I'm talking about drug pushers who destroy people's lives. There are drug pushers and members of the mafia who are happy people. The reality is that despite what society has tried to brainwash you into believing, there's no correlation between being a good person and being a happy person. The reality is that if you want to be a happy person, what you have to do is have self-acceptance. You have to give yourself permission to be who you are. In other words, in terms of happiness, it's better to be a rotten person who gives yourself permission to be rotten than to be a good person who doesn't give yourself permission to be not so good in certain areas. I'm saying that the key to happiness is not being a wonderful person, it's giving yourself permission to be who you are. So let's talk about self-acceptance. Let's talk about how to give yourself permission to be who you are, which means, in some cases, giving yourself permission to be rotten. There are a number of steps in developing self-acceptance. Step number one is to stop using the filthiest word in the English language. Now, this is not a four-letter word. This is actually a six-letter word. But it is the filthiest word in the English language because it causes more unhappiness, more pain, than any other word that you can find in the Webster Dictionary. That word, which is the filthiest word in the English language, is the word should. The word should is the one word that destroys people's self-acceptance and destroys any chance that they might have at being a happy, well-adjusted human being. You see, the problem with the word should is it implies that there's something wrong with me if I don't behave in a certain pattern. I should be more honest. I should be more patient. I should work harder. All of these words imply that if I'm not that honest, or if I don't work that hard, if I'm not that giving of a person, then that means that I'm bad. And the result is low self-acceptance and unhappiness. So the first step in developing self-acceptance is to stop using that filthy word should, and to just give yourself permission to be who you are. Here's a homework assignment. Get yourself a piece of paper and something to write with, and when I give the instructions, stop the tape so that you can do the assignment. It's very critical that you do all of the assignments on this tape as I give them to you. If you just try to breeze through this tape, you're going to find that the tape has a limited value. The lasting value in this tape will come from doing the assignments. So once you have your piece of paper and your pen, what I want you to do is to write down a should list. And each of the lines is going to begin the same way, I should. So just list as many shoulds as possible, one after another, each line beginning with the words, I should. Stop the tape. Hopefully you did the homework assignment and you have a long list of shoulds. The next step of the assignment is to cross out that word should and replace it with a word that does not destroy your self-acceptance. The word that I recommend is the word wish. So instead of saying I should lose weight, write down instead I wish I would lose weight. Or instead of writing down I should be a better person, write down I wish I were a better person. Instead of saying I should lose 50 pounds, write down I wish I would lose 50 pounds. So go through your should list, cross out the word should, and replace it with the word wish. Or if you prefer, replace it with the word may, or with the word might, or replace it with the word I would like. So instead of saying I wish I were more attentive to my friends, you could say I might be more attentive to my friends, or I may be more attentive to my friends, or it would be nice if I were more attentive to my friends. So your next homework assignment is to go down your should list, cross out the word should, and replace it with a better word. Stop the tape. Hopefully you did the assignment, and now you're ready to move on to step number 2 for self-acceptance. And that is to stop insulting yourself. Stop calling yourself names. If I were to walk up to you and say, you know, you're fat, you're ugly, you're stupid, you're disgusting, you probably would get very angry at me. In fact, you might even get violent. Well, of course, I would never say those things to you. But guess what? You probably say things like that, and even worse things than that, to yourself every day of your life. You know, there's an old saying that we're all our own worst enemies, and it's true. The insults that we would not tolerate from anybody else in the world, we tolerate from ourselves. We call ourselves horrible things all of the time. Your next homework assignment is, again, with your piece of paper and your pen, to write down a list of insults that you have called yourself in your life. For example, if you've called yourself a fat slob, any point in your life, write that down. If you've ever called yourself a loser, if you've ever called yourself an idiot, if you've ever called yourself selfish or uncaring or cold or callous, if you've ever called yourself frigid, any negative label that you've ever attached to yourself, the homework assignment is to write those labels down right now. Stop the tape. Hopefully you have a long list of insults on your insult list. Your next homework assignment is to cross out all of these insults and replace them with a non-judgmental, specific description of your behavior. I repeat, your assignment is to take each of these insults, cross them out, and replace them with a non-judgmental, specific description of your behavior. Let me give you an example. Suppose you wrote down that I'm a fat slob. Well, that's an insult that will destroy your self-concept. What you want to do is cross that out and replace it with a non-judgmental, specific description of your behavior. For example, you could say, I weigh 150 pounds. Now, that's not lying to yourself. That's not evading reality. You're being 100% honest with yourself. That's how much you weigh. But you're being non-judgmental. You're using a non-pejorative, specific description of your behavior. In this case, I weigh 150 pounds. Your homework assignment is to go through each of the insults that you have on your piece of paper, cross them out, and replace them with non-judgmental, specific descriptions of your behavior. So instead of saying that I'm frigid, you could say, 80% of the time I do not achieve orgasm when I have sexual intercourse. Or instead of saying I'm a selfish, uncaring person, you cross that out and say, sometimes I choose myself instead of the person that I'm with. So your homework assignment, to repeat one last time, is to go down your list of insults, cross them out, and replace them with non-judgmental, specific descriptions of your behavior. Stop the tape and do the assignment. That's step number 2 in developing self-acceptance. Stop insulting yourself. We're now ready to move on to step number 3 in developing self-acceptance, and that is stop judging others. You know, it's sometimes fun to judge others critically. It makes us feel a little bit better if we can say so-and-so is too fat, or so-and-so is stupid, or so-and-so is selfish, or so-and-so is lazy, or so-and-so is a failure, or so-and-so is too shy. We compare ourselves and we look a little bit better in comparison with these other people. The problem, however, with being judgmental of other people is it develops a bad habit. And sooner or later, you're going to turn this judgmental habit onto yourself. That's the problem with being judgmental. Ultimately, you wind up being judgmental of yourself. And each time you judge yourself to be too fat or too shy or too quiet or too selfish or too lazy or a failure or stupid or whatever it is that you're judging yourself to be, you are reducing your self-esteem. You are destroying your chances of being a happy, well-adjusted human being. So if you want to break that habit of being judgmental towards yourself, the way to do it is to stop being judgmental of other people. Your homework assignment for the next 24 hours, pay attention to how often you're judgmental of other people. How often do you allow yourself to be critical of others in your own mind? Just pay attention to that for the next 24 hours. And once you're aware of how judgmental you are, make a decision that you're going to work for the rest of your life in being less judgmental of others in the hopes of reducing the amount of time you spend being judgmental of yourself. So that's the third step towards developing self-acceptance. Stop being judgmental of other people. Step number four in developing high self-esteem, or pardon me, high self-acceptance, is to avoid the vultures in your life. Now, we all know about the birds of prey that are called vultures. These are birds that circle around and look for innocent victims, dying, weak, young, defenseless victims. They just swoop down from the sky and they rip into them with their sharp claws and their sharp beaks. Well, there are also human vultures out there, people that are trying to tear apart, rip apart your self-esteem. Now, we all know who these people are. In fact, your homework assignment in a few minutes is going to be to stop the tape and to write down the names of the worst vultures in your life. Now again, the definition of a vulture is a person who tears apart your self-acceptance. Somebody that tries to convince you that you're a bad person and that you don't have a right to be who you are, that it's not okay to be you. Now to a certain extent, you could probably write down the names of everybody you know, because to some extent, probably everybody is going to be a vulture in our own lives. Well, we don't want to be in a situation where we have to become hermits and avoid contact with all human beings because on occasion they may be vultures. What we're talking about are the worst vultures in our lives, the people who habitually work at destroying our self-esteem. So in a few minutes, what I'm going to ask you to do is to stop the tape and write down the names of these vultures in your lives. Now, it can be a parent, it can be a, quote, friend, it can be your boss, it can be a neighbor, it can be a cousin, it could be a member of your club, it could be a member of your church, it could be a romantic partner, it could even be your children. Write down the names of the vultures in your life, the worst vultures. Do that now. Stop the tape. One advantage of being a single person is you probably have a lot more freedom than married people do. Because what can you do if you're married to a vulture? And the answer is you can get a divorce. The reality is that most people don't want to go through a divorce because it's extremely painful. There are also problems with the children and financial reasons and what will the neighbors think. And there are also religious problems with going through a divorce. The reality is that divorce, as many of you I'm sure know, is an extremely painful experience. And most of us want to avoid going through that experience. The advantage of being single is if you don't have the problem of being married to a vulture, you have the freedom to choose a romantic partner who does not destroy your self-acceptance. And that's your next homework assignment. Whenever you date, whenever you meet people socially, I want you to decide who you want as a romantic partner on the basis of what they do to your self-acceptance. In other words, if you meet somebody who's constantly critical of you and judgmental of you and is detrimental to your self-acceptance, your homework assignment is going to be to not date that person and to limit your exposure to that person. Now, if your parents are vultures, you have a problem because most people feel a moral obligation to spend some time with their parents. After all, this is the person who gave you life. Well, my suggestion to you is, if your parents are vultures, if they're always saying, how come you're still single? How come you don't make more money? Why don't you lose weight? Why don't you stop smoking? Why aren't you more successful in life? Why aren't you more successful with your children? And on and on and on. If you have parents that are vultures, my suggestion to you would really be to stop seeing them altogether. That would be the ideal thing to do. Unfortunately, most people are in a situation where if they stop seeing their parents, they would feel so guilty, it would destroy their self-acceptance even more. So let me propose a compromise. If your parents are vultures, and if you're not willing to totally lose contact with them, my suggestion to you would be to limit the amount of time that you spend with your parents. And the same holds true with any vultures in your life. If your boss is a vulture, the best solution is to quit your job, or if you work for a large enough company, to transfer into a different department where you have a different boss. Because bosses can be very, very detrimental to your self-acceptance. But if you're not willing to do that, the solution instead would be to limit the amount of time that you spend with your boss. As much as possible, see if you can be independent of your boss. You know, spend more time out in the field, or one way or another, avoid contact with your boss. The best solution with vultures is to totally avoid them, but if you're not willing to do that, at least try to cut down the amount of time that you spend with these human vultures. Getting back to the romantic partners, never get into a romantic relationship with a person who's detrimental to your self-acceptance. Make that the number one requirement on your list. It's far more important that they not be judgmental of you. It's far more important that they not damage your self-acceptance than that they have a lot of money, or that they be good-looking, or that they have a great sense of humor. You can be a happy, well-adjusted human being married to a person who doesn't have a lot of money, or isn't good-looking, or isn't the wittiest person in the room. But you cannot be happy. You cannot have a successful marriage to a vulture. So choose your romantic partners, number one, on the basis of what they do to your self-acceptance. That is step number four in developing self-acceptance. And now let's move on to step number five, very, very critical final step in developing self-acceptance, and that is to develop a realistic moral code. All of us have a moral code, and each person listening to this tape right now has a slightly different moral code than all the others. There are a lot of areas in life that are moral dilemmas. There are situations in which it's difficult to decide what's right and what's wrong. Let me give you an example. This is a favorite one of mine. Suppose that you were a married person, and suppose you engaged in an act of adultery. Suppose you were unfaithful to your spouse. Now, I'm not going to ask you whether you think it's good or bad, moral or immoral, to be faithful or unfaithful to your partner. I think it's almost generally accepted in our society that it's wrong to step out on your husband or wife or boyfriend or girlfriend if you've made a commitment to them to be faithful. So let's assume that there's not much controversy on that. But suppose you have been unfaithful to your husband or wife. What should you do? Should you confess to them that you did something wrong and promise to never do it again? Or should you keep your adultery a secret? Now, this is a difficult moral problem. In fact, I read in the Reader's Digest a few years back where they asked six very famous teachers in the United States, very famous therapists, what they would counsel a client to do. Now, I've asked this question at different times in my classes with singles, and it's interesting. Approximately half the people in the class usually say, be honest, confess, say you won't do it again, beg for forgiveness. And the other half usually says, boy, you'd be a fool to tell people that you were unfaithful. You'll only destroy the marriage. You'll only destroy the romantic relationship. And then there are always a few people who say, well, I would do this under certain circumstances and do something differently with a different person. The point I'm trying to make is, here's an example of a moral dilemma where it's very, very difficult to decide what's right and what's wrong. You could have people that, you know, most people would regard as being good people, moral people, who would disagree among themselves as to what's the right thing to do and what's the wrong thing to do. You know, a lot of times people say, I have no problem making decisions about moral problems. All I have to do is consult the Bible. Well, the reality is that you could get 10 biblical experts together, people that have spent their entire lives studying the Bible, and they would argue among themselves what's right and what's wrong under certain specific circumstances. The point I'm making is that we're all human beings, and as human beings, anything that we believe is subject to error. No matter how honest we are with ourselves, no matter how hard we work at arriving at the truth, the reality is, as human beings, we all make mistakes. Anything that we believe can be wrong. And the same holds true for morality. Every person listening right now has a slightly different moral code. And who's to say that my moral code is better or worse than your moral code, or that anybody else's moral code is better or worse than yours? The reality is that it's just a matter of opinion, and there is no certain method for determining what's right and what's wrong under every circumstance. So if that's true, if every moral code is an individual moral code, and if every moral code is subject to error, why not choose a realistic moral code? Now, what I mean by a realistic moral code is a moral code that you can live by, a moral code that you can follow reasonably easily the vast majority of the time. Now, probably very few of us are able to follow our moral code 100% of the time. I think that's asking a little bit too much. But I think most of us can follow our moral code most of the time. Now, the reason that it's important to have a realistic moral code, a moral code that you can follow most of the time, is because the penalty for breaking your moral code is always a loss of self-acceptance. The more often you violate your moral code, the lower opinion you're going to have of yourself, the less happy of a human being you're going to be. So it's critical, if you want to be a happy, well-adjusted human being, if you want to have self-acceptance, you must develop a realistic moral code, a moral code that you can follow the vast majority of the time. I give myself as an example. I follow my moral code the vast majority of the time, so I can honestly say to myself, Rich, you are a good person. Now, that's critical if you want to have self-acceptance. You have to have a moral code that you can live by. Now, my moral code may be very different from yours, and that's not the point, because nobody really knows for a fact which moral code is the best. The point is, my moral code is a good moral code because it works for me. It's a moral code that's realistic. It's a moral code that I can follow the vast majority of the time so that I can honestly say to myself, I'm a good human being, and have self-acceptance. With that self-acceptance that comes from a realistic moral code comes mental health and happiness. So that's your final homework assignment for self-acceptance. Develop a realistic moral code. Your homework assignment is going to be to write down all these situations in which you have difficulty living up to your moral code. We all have certain weak areas. It could be in the area of sexuality, as an example. Single people have a tough time with sexuality because society teaches us that it's immoral to engage in sexual activity if we are single. So if you're in that kind of situation where you're having difficulty living up to your moral code in the sexual area, if you find that it's difficult for you to go through months or possibly even years without sexual contact because your moral code tells you that it's wrong to have sex outside of marriage, that's an area that you might want to reconsider. I'm not going to argue with you right now whether it's good or bad to have sex in or out of marriage. That's not the purpose of this tape. The purpose of this tape is to teach you self-acceptance. And I'm going to suggest to you that it is going to be impossible for you to have self-acceptance, and it's going to be impossible for you to be a happy, well-adjusted human being if you happen to be single and you're engaging in sexual activity outside of marriage and your moral code tells you that it's wrong to have sexual activity outside of marriage. So this is just one area that I'm going to ask you to consider in your homework assignment. Go through the areas in your life that you're having a difficult time following your moral code. Sexual activity is only one of many, many areas. I'm going to ask you to reconsider your moral code and ask yourself, can I live up to this moral code? Is this something that realistically I can live up to? Now, a lot of times people tell me, hey, there's no reason in the world why a person can't live up to their moral code. There's no reason why people can't change themselves so that they follow their moral code. Well, the answer is yes, it's true. Theoretically, it's possible for any human being to change themselves so they can live up to their moral code. The reality, however, is that most of us, for whatever reason, are not going to be successful in changing ourselves. You know, there was a study that was done on New Year's resolutions, and they found out something very shocking. They found out that 96% of all New Year's resolutions get broken by January 15th. In other words, there's less than a 4% chance that you will ever change any negative quality of yourself. In other words, if you're overweight and you decide, okay, I'm going to go on a diet and lose weight, the reality is that there's less than a 4% chance that you'll be able to lose that weight. In fact, they've done studies that indicate that 98% of people that go on diets either don't lose much weight or regain the weight within a 2-year period of time. So there's really less than a 2% chance that you'll ever lose weight permanently if you are an overweight person. And that's true for just about any other quality in your life that you're trying to change. I'm not just talking about moral areas. I'm talking about areas that have nothing to do with morality. If, for example, you see yourself as not being a hard-working person and you want to become a harder-working person, so you set up a resolution, okay, I'm going to work X number of hours more per week, the reality is that you have less than a 4% chance of ever achieving that goal. So what I'm suggesting to you is, change is a wonderful thing. We all have negative qualities that we would like to change. As single people, maybe we'd like to change the fact that we're shy. So we say, okay, my resolution is that I'm going to overcome my fear of rejection. I'm going to go out there and just get rejected right and left without worrying about it. I'm going to be able to go to a dance or a party or a singles bar or a picnic and just walk up to 5, 10, 15 people at that party. And even if none of them find me attractive and turn me down, I'm still going to feel self-confident enough to go up with the 16th person and ask them to dance. Well, that's a wonderful resolution. That's a wonderful goal. The reality is that most of us are never going to achieve that goal. Most of us are never going to overcome our fear of rejection. So if that's true, why not give yourself permission to be a shy person? Why not give yourself permission to be a person who's afraid of rejection? Why not give yourself permission to be a person who goes to dances or parties and has difficulty meeting people because you're afraid of getting your feelings hurt? And the same holds true for any area of your life. Give yourself permission to be who you are. So in the case of morality, give yourself permission to be the kind of person you are and develop a moral code which reflects the kind of person you are. Give yourself a realistic chance of meeting your moral code. Give yourself a reasonable chance of being the person that you want to be. Don't set up a situation where you have such lofty goals and such lofty standards and such strict rules of morality that it's going to be next to impossible, less than a 4% chance of ever achieving these goals or meeting this moral code. Because if you do that, it's a recipe for disaster. You will be setting yourself up for having low self-esteem, being unhappy and unhealthy for the rest of your life. Now, I realize that some of the suggestions I'm giving on this tape are quite controversial. Definitely, they are completely contrary to what society will teach you. Society will try to teach you that you should change yourself if you have any negative qualities. I have nothing against changing yourself. I just don't like that use of the word should, that you should change yourself. I would like to have you cross out that word should for the rest of your life and replace it with the word wish. I wish I were a better person. I wish I would change myself in certain areas. There's nothing wrong with having goals. There's nothing wrong with wanting to be a good person. You know, the commercials on television for the Army are be the best that you can be. It's my firm belief that every person listening to this tape and every person in the world is trying to be the best person they can be. I've never met a person who wants to be the worst person they can be. Everybody is striving to be the best that they can be. The reality is that it's difficult to be successful at all of our goals. The reality is that there's less than a 4% chance that we will ever change ourselves in any particular area. So there's nothing wrong with wanting to be the best that you can be, as long as you give yourself permission to not be the best in every single area of your life. Give yourself permission to be who you are. And you know something? In the long run, you'll be a better person if you have self-acceptance. Because you see, if you don't have self-acceptance, if you don't give yourself permission to be who you are, you're going to wind up being very, very unhappy. You're going to wind up having low self-esteem. You're going to be mentally unhealthy. And guess what? You're going to make other people around you less happy. A lot of times people object to some of the suggestions on this tape, saying, Rich, you know, if people give themselves permission to be who they are, then that means that they're going to give themselves permission to be murderers, and they're going to give themselves permission to be rapists, and they're going to give themselves permission to abuse children and to abuse their wives and to abuse alcohol and so forth. I'm not suggesting anything of the sort. I'm not suggesting that it's good to be a murderer or a rapist or an alcoholic or a drug addict or a child abuser. But I'll go one step further. It's my opinion that the people that go out and commit murders and rape and abuse children are people with low self-esteem. They're people who don't give themselves permission to be who they are. They're people who have unrealistic moral codes that they find impossible to live up to. And as a result, because of that low self-esteem, they wind up doing horrible things in our society. They wind up murdering and raping and abusing children and so forth. The reality is that if you want to be a good person, the first step is to give yourself permission to be a person who's not good in all areas. If, on the other hand, you set up unrealistic expectations of yourself, if you have an unrealistic goal that you be good in every area, the ultimate result is low self-acceptance, and you wind up being a worse person than you would have been if you had given yourself permission to have some faults. What I'm suggesting is it's not an all-or-nothing situation where either you're a wonderful person or you're a rotten person. The reality is that all of us are going to be good in some areas and bad in some areas. And the first step towards becoming a better human being and becoming a more moral human being is to give yourself permission to be who you are. If you do that, you are well on your way towards becoming a wonderful person. So those are the five steps towards developing self-acceptance. My suggestion to you is that you not take these suggestions lightly, but rather that you work on these 5 points every day for the rest of your life. And if you do that, you'll develop self-acceptance, you'll give yourself permission to be who you are, and you will be a happy human being for the rest of your life. Well, self-acceptance is good, but there's something even better than self-acceptance, and it's called self-esteem. So let's talk about how we can move from self-acceptance to self-esteem. I guess you could describe self-esteem as being the frosting on the cake. You can eat a cake which is plain, which doesn't have frosting, which tastes good and which will satisfy your hunger. That's what self-acceptance does. It gives you a chance at being happy, and it's critical, because without self-acceptance, you cannot be a healthy, well-adjusted human being, and you cannot be happy. But wouldn't it be nice to add frosting to that cake? Would it not be a more delicious cake? That's what self-esteem does. Because, you see, self-esteem goes further than just saying it's okay to be me. Self-esteem says, I'm a wonderful person, and I love myself. If you have self-esteem, to the extent that you have self-esteem, you'll be infinitely happier than if you just have self-acceptance. So the prerequisite for happiness and mental health is not self-esteem, it's self-acceptance. But if you can add self-acceptance, if you can add self-esteem to self-acceptance, now you're really off to the races in terms of being a happy, well-adjusted human being. So how do you do that? Step number one in developing high self-esteem is to give yourself permission to have high self-esteem. Now, this sounds kind of silly because everybody usually says, well, why wouldn't I give myself permission to have high self-esteem? Well, the reality is that society doesn't give you permission to have high self-esteem. The reality is that society teaches us to be humble people. Now, humility is considered to be a virtue, but the reality is that humility is just a euphemism for low self-esteem. Show me a person who is humble, and I'll show you a person who, A, either has a low opinion of themselves, or B, is a liar and is pretending to have a low opinion of themselves. See, a lot of people have high self-esteem, but they play what I call the humility game. They pretend to have low self-esteem because they know that the key to being popular is to play the humility game. See, society kind of is hypocritical about this. On the one hand, society teaches us that self-esteem is wonderful, and you can't have too much self-esteem. Society is almost unanimous in saying that self-esteem is the key to mental health, and the more self-esteem you have, the better. But on the other hand, society teaches us that if we're honest about our high self-esteem, if we tell people, hey, I'm a wonderful person, the reality is most people will hate our guts. You see, most people have low self-esteem. And people with low self-esteem don't feel comfortable being around people who have high self-esteem who are honest about it. A person with low self-esteem who's around a person who has high self-esteem usually feels inferior. Their self-esteem gets even lower than when they weren't around the person with high self-esteem. So as a result, most people who have low self-esteem feel uncomfortable being around people with high self-esteem. And they will literally hate your guts if you are honest about your high self-esteem. So I'm not suggesting that you can't be a popular person with high self-esteem. What I'm saying is you can't be a popular person and be honest about your high self-esteem. People will call you egotistical. They will say that you're bragging if you tell them how wonderful you are. So the secret to being happy in life is to develop high self-esteem, but keep it a secret. Don't let anybody ever even suspect that you might think that you're a wonderful person. Now, if you want to play the humility game, you can. Personally, I find it repulsive to pretend to be humble when I'm not. I have a high opinion of myself, and I let everybody around me know about that. Now, the reality is that a lot of people hate my guts, especially people with low self-esteem, because, as I said, people with low self-esteem don't feel comfortable with people with high self-esteem who are honest about it because it makes them feel inferior. But the reality is, if you want to be a popular person, you have to keep your high self-esteem to yourself. So here's a case where I'm suggesting that you do as I say rather than as I do. I'm not willing to keep my self-esteem to myself. I'm not willing to play the humility game and pretend that I don't think that I'm wonderful. But I pay a price for that. I pay the price that I'm not popular with everyone. There are a lot of people out there that dislike me because I'm honest about my self-esteem. If you want to avoid the price I pay, if you want to be popular with everybody, particularly if you want to be popular with the people with low self-esteem, who, by the way, are the overwhelming majority of people out there, you're going to have to play the humility game. You're going to have to keep your high self-esteem to yourself. So the choice is yours. But step number one in developing high self-esteem is to give yourself permission to have high self-esteem. Don't go along with society when they say that it's wrong to have a high opinion of yourself, that it's egotistical to have a high opinion of yourself. The reality is that egotism and high self-esteem are synonymous. There's absolutely no difference between those two words. The reality is that society is hypocritical. It teaches us to have a high self-esteem, but then if we do have that high self-esteem and let people know about it, it condemns us as being egotistical. The reality is that there's nothing wrong with being egotistical. There's nothing wrong with having high self-esteem. In fact, my goal in life is to be the most egotistical person on the planet Earth. I want to convince myself that I am the most wonderful person that ever lived. Now, I haven't succeeded in that yet, but I still have a few more years to try to achieve that goal. But I would suggest that as a homework assignment to you, to give yourself permission to be egotistical. Don't be foolish and let people know that you have a high opinion of yourself. Keep your high self-esteem a secret, but give yourself permission to believe that you are a wonderful person. Because it really is true that there's no such thing as too much self-esteem. Just as there's no such thing as having too much money, or too much love, or too much success, or too many friends, or too much health, it's also impossible to have too much self-esteem. The more self-esteem you have, the healthier human being you're going to be, the happier person you're going to be. So give yourself permission to be the most egotistical person on the planet. That's my goal. I recommend it that you make it your goal as well. Step number two in developing high self-esteem is to develop a long, wonderful list. See, what you need to do is to convince yourself that you're a wonderful person. And the way you do it, and this is going to be your homework assignment, is to write a long list of areas in which you are wonderful. Your homework assignment is to write as long of a list as possible, each line beginning with the following words, "I'm wonderful because." And I suggest that you write, "I'm wonderful because," each separate line, and then list each of the qualities that complete that sentence. So do that assignment. And remember to make this list as long as possible. Humility doesn't get you points in this game. What gets you points in this game is high self-esteem. The more areas in which you can convince yourself you're wonderful, the higher your self-esteem will be, the happier you will be. So do the assignment by listing every area in which I am wonderful because. Stop the tape and do the assignment. What do you do if your wonderful list isn't long enough? And the answer is step number three, lie to yourself. Make up wonderful qualities that are not true. Now, there's a word for this, a euphemism for lying to yourself about how wonderful you are. It's called affirmations. See, with affirmations, the theory is that if you want to change yourself into a better person, for example, if you want to lose weight, instead of writing down, "I want to lose weight," what you do is you write down an affirmation. You pretend that you've already been successful in changing this quality about yourself. So the affirmation would read, "I have a slim body." Now the reality is, as you write this affirmation down, you're still 20, 30, 50, 100 pounds overweight. But the theory behind affirmations is, if you repeat the affirmation over and over and over again, "I have a slim body, I have a slim body, I have a slim body," you write it down over and over again, you repeat it to yourself in the morning and the evening, you write it down on a piece of paper and you have it by your bed, you have it taped to your mirror in the bathroom, you have it on your dashboard of your car as you drive to work, "I'm a slim person, I'm a slim person." You go to work and there in your desk you have it right there, "I'm a slim person." The theory is if you repeat this affirmation over and over and over again, you will change your self-concept, you will convince yourself that you're a slim person, and then you will almost miraculously lose the weight. Well, the sad reality is that affirmations don't always work. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. But I'm here to tell you that it really doesn't make any difference whether the affirmation works or not. Because if you convince yourself that you're a wonderful person, it doesn't make any difference whether you really are or not. your self-esteem will increase and you will be a happier person. What I'm suggesting is you don't have to lose 50 pounds in order to convince yourself that you are a slim person or that you have a beautiful body. All you have to do is tell yourself every day over and over again, I have a beautiful body, I have a beautiful body, I have a beautiful body, and you can continue to be 50 pounds overweight. See, what we're talking about is programming your subconscious mind. Your subconscious mind is stupid. It can't think for itself. All it can do is believe whatever you tell it. So if you tell your mind over and over and over again, I have a beautiful body, I have a beautiful body, I have a beautiful body, you don't have to have a beautiful body. That's totally irrelevant. All you have to do is convince yourself. And if you don't contradict it by saying, no, I'm a fat slob, no, I'm a fat slob, sooner or later you will convince yourself that you have a beautiful body. And the same holds true for any other area of your life. Your wonderful list is hopefully fairly long, but your homework assignment is to add to your wonderful list affirmations. Choose all of the areas in your life that you don't like yourself. For example, maybe you feel that you're overly shy with the opposite sex, or maybe you feel that you're not a good enough conversationalist, or maybe you feel that you're not a good enough listener, or maybe you think you're not good in bed, or maybe you believe that you're not good at raising your children, or you're not a hard enough worker, or you're not a good enough cook, or you're not good enough at playing golf or tennis or racquetball or ballet or whatever it is that you like to do in your spare time. Whatever area in your life that you don't like, which is reducing your self-esteem, your homework assignment is to write an affirmation down as part of your wonderful list. Just write down, I am very self-confident with the opposite sex, even though you're really not. Or I have a beautiful slim body. Or I have a lovely nose, even though you're thinking of rhinoplasty. Or I'm very successful with the opposite sex. Or I'm very desirable to the opposite sex, even though you get rejected often at dances or parties or other social events. Your homework assignment is to write down affirmations, add them to your wonderful list. That's step number 3. Do that now.